This is edition number 1990 of the Mardler, recorded in Aylsham on Friday, the 24th of October, 2025. Hello, you're listening to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper for North Norfolk. Today we bring you the week's news and views from the North Norfolk News of Thursday, the 23rd of October, 2025. My name is Tony Escrit, and my fellow readers are...
Barbara Calver,
Julie Reeve,
and Ruth Harrison.
On the notice board today... This week, the sun will rise around 07:35 and will set at about 17:45. If you're marking a birthday, an anniversary, or any special moment this week, the whole team here at the Mardler send you a hearty congratulations and our very best wishes. Please remember to put your clocks back on Sunday, 26th of October.
The magazine supplement will follow a little later in the programme and includes stories and features that span land, sea and sound, from the sweeping shores in Around Our Coast Completed to the nostalgic journeys of First Wheels and the icy adventures in Tales from the Frozen North. There's something to stir every imagination. Plus, don't miss our regular rhythm-infused favourite, My Music for You, bringing personal playlists and musical memories to life.
But we begin with the main news items, which include stolen village sign found, rural schools in trouble, former railway village gets a makeover, and an ancient hedge halts couple's bid to build. But let's begin with those lead stories.
A man's sudden personality shift, which left him making sarcastic and spiteful comments to his loved ones, was actually a symptom of a deadly tumour. Henry Barringer, 35, started to change in 2023. It peaked in May when he was holidaying in France with his wife Rebecca, their friends, and their two-year-old son Edward. Mrs. Barringer, an architect from North Walsham, said, "We bickered more than usual. His comments became more spiteful and he was saying things that were completely out of character. I no longer recognised the man I had married." Mr. Barringer, an amateur rugby player, then started experiencing severe migraines and vomiting, and a CT scan in June 2023 uncovered an incurable brain tumour. "It was hard to take everything in," Mrs. Barringer recalled. "I'd been dealing with being on the brunt of Henry's symptoms while parenting our son. We were both exhausted and struggled to understand exactly what having a brain tumour meant for Henry. After 2 months of radiotherapy and chemotherapy treatment, Mr. Barringer's personality returned." Feeling optimistic, his parents, Linda, 65, and Robert, 64, paid thousands to send a sample of his tumour to the USA to try to access alternative treatment not available in the UK. But Mr. Barringer died before the results arrived in May 2024. Since his death, his loved ones have banded together to raise awareness for brain tumours and how complex they can be to treat. They have raised thousands of pounds by hosting a rugby match for the Brain Tumour Research Charity, and his former colleagues are also taking on the National Three Peaks Challenge in his memory in May 2026. Charlie Arlesbrook, Community Development Manager at Brain Tumour Research, said Henry's story, sadly, not uncommon. "One in three people in the UK knows someone affected by a brain tumour. There are more than 100 different types of brain tumour, making them notoriously difficult to find effective treatments for. Despite this complexity, treatment options have barely changed in decades. We're grateful to Rebecca and all who knew Henry who have done and continue to fundraise to help fund vital research into brain tumours.
A village sign stolen from one of Norfolk's smallest villages has been found hundreds of miles away 7 years after it first went missing. The handmade sign of Branstead, also known somewhat confusingly as Bramstead, had stood at the entrance to the village for more than 30 years and devastated locals when it disappeared in 2018. Now, in a strange turn of events, the honesty of an antiques dealer from Lincolnshire may mean it will soon be returned to its rightful home. Andy Whitmill, who runs a workshop in Grimsby, Lincolnshire, said he purchased the sign for £80 at a large antiques show last year. Oblivious to its tainted past, he discovered the murky origins after researching the purchase and stumbling upon an article in this newspaper detailing the theft. He then contacted Humberside Police, who in turn messaged the paper to say it was looking into the matter. "I read the report that they were absolutely devastated and really upset," said Mr. Whitmell. "If someone had come in and stolen my sign, I would have been as well." The sign, which is around 3 foot across, had previously stood by the main road of the village between Stalham and Walcott. Its design, a man on horse-drawn rake, was inspired by the former village pub, the Orchard Farm. Mr. Whitmell said he's now intent on returning it to its rightful home. "I would really just love to give it back. I really would," he said. Hopefully, it's a feel-good story that there are genuinely honest people out there and out of bad can come good. Branstead, near Stalham, is one of the smallest communities in Norfolk, with a population of around 65 people. A spokeswoman from the parish council said the discovery was unexpected, but that they would definitely like it back.
An amphibious reed cutting machine has been put to work at a Norfolk Wildlife Reserve with the help of a deeply generous legacy donation. The Swedish-built truck saw machine is being used to maintain reed beds at the Norfolk Wildlife Trust Coastal Reserve at Clye and Salthouse Marshes. The equipment costs more than £120,000, of which 60% was funded with a grant from the Farming and Protected Landscapes Programme, administered by the Norfolk Coast Protected Landscape on behalf of DEFRA. NWD said the remainder was funded by a deeply generous legacy gift from Peter Sinclair, an inspirational economics professor who grew up in Leatheringset near Holt, before embarking on an academic career teaching at Brasenose College in Oxford and Birmingham University, as well as becoming director of the Bank of England's Centre for Central Banking Studies. Mr. Sinclair died at the age of 73 in 2020 after contracting COVID-19. But NWD said his legacy gift will support the future conservation of the Clye and Salthouse and Hickling marshes. George Baldock, the Trust's Coastal Reserve Manager, said the lightweight amphibious machine had allowed access to previously inaccessible reed beds. "We've only just started using the truck saw machine at Clye, but there are already a lot of people in the bird hides asking about it. As we are moving it on and off site, because it's quite a unique machine. It's on tracks with paddles on them. It will drive from a firm surface onto a boggy marsh, or it will float on open water, so we can get to areas we could not previously get to. At Clye, for example, we've got an area that has been restored, so the water is much deeper. Going forward, we can now maintain that area as part of our cutting rotation work at Clye. The reed beds are cut in rotation to keep the bottom of the reed bed clean and wet. If it does not get cut, there will be an accumulation of leaf litter and other material, and if you left it long enough, it would scrub up with willow and other trees. We are trying to stop that happening and maintain it as a wet habitat."
The former owner of a cafe on the Norfolk coast has been warned he must prepare himself for custody after he was convicted of rape. Andrew Hubbard had gone on trial accused of a number of offences against the woman, who cannot be identified for legal reasons, including two counts of rape, kidnap, and controlling and coercive behaviour. The 34-year-old, who previously owned Lily Mays, formerly Kraft Burger, in Cromer's New Street, denied all offences, said to have occurred between August 2022 and April 2023. But on Tuesday, October 21st, Hubbard was unanimously found guilty of one count of rape and another offence of controlling and coercive behaviour. Jurors at Norwich Crown Court reached the guilty verdicts after more than 11 hours and 30 minutes of deliberations. Hubbard was found not guilty of another count of rape. He was also cleared of an offence of kidnap and another offence of voyeurism. Earlier in the trial, which started last month, the jury were directed to find Hubbard not guilty of another offence of escape from lawful custody. Judge Anthony Bate adjourned sentencing until December 15th to allow a pre-sentence report to be carried out. But he warned Hubbard, the outcome is almost inevitable and he should prepare yourself for custody. The trial heard Hubbard came into the bedroom of a property in Cromer with his genitals exposed before raping the victim. Jurors were told by the prosecution the woman knew he wanted her to perform oral sex on him and only did so as she was so scared at that time. Hubbard, formerly of Hannah Close Sheringham, but now of St Mary's Close Rowton, was granted conditional bail. He must live and sleep each night at the address and abide by a curfew between 10 p.m. and 7 a.m.
A couple's hopes to build a new home in the countryside have been dashed by planners over fears for wildlife and an ancient hedge. Developers, named in planning papers as Mr. and Mrs. Revilius, have been refused outline permission for the property at Stiffkey near Wells. North Norfolk District Council said it was in an area designated as countryside with poor facilities. Locals objected to the proposals for a house, annex and garage on land off Wells Road. Stiffkey Parish Council objected because the site is in open countryside and home to protected species, including reptiles and nocturnal wildlife. One villager said the proposed site has been an unworked field for the last 50 years. As such, it has become home to many small creatures, including lizards, stoats, weasels and shrews, as well as a hunting ground for barn owls, kites, buzzards, sparrowhawks, and at night time an important feeding area for tawny owls and bats. A neighbour said creating an access to the site would involve removing part of a mature hedgerow, believed to be 200 years old. A planning officer's report said the proposals would result in the loss of a substantial length of the hedge, which is described as a defining feature on the approach to the village. It added, "This loss of vegetation would significantly alter the landscape character in this part of the village." A planning statement said Mr. and Mrs. Revilius were already residents of the area who currently live in Holt. They have for some time wished to build their own home and to move to a village, it said. It added the property would be their main residence and built to high environmental standards.
Falling pupil numbers are likely to have a significant impact on some of Norfolk's smaller schools, and some may close, councillors have warned. Almost 30 of Norfolk's smaller schools have fewer than 50 pupils, county councillors revealed, amid concern over what the future holds. Education bosses at Norfolk County Council are holding talks with schools about how to plan for the decline, and councillors said changes could be needed for the best interests of children. At a meeting of County Hall's Conservative-controlled Cabinet on Monday, councillors were told the number of children who started reception year in September was under 8,000, even lower than had been forecast. and Penny Carpenter, Cabinet Member for Children's Services, said demographics suggested it could dip below 6,000 in the years ahead. Mrs. Carpenter said the average age of women having their first child in 2023 had increased to 29 from 27 in 2003, and that the pattern was unlikely to be reversed any time soon. She said, combined with the fact that we already have numerous small schools and declining numbers, this will have a significant impact on school viability in numerous areas. Mrs. Carpenter said 218 primary schools had fewer than 200 pupils, while 29 have fewer than 50 children on roll. She said, in short, Norfolk has smaller schools than most other local authorities. School funding is directly linked to the number on roll, so education officials are worried smaller schools, particularly in rural areas, could struggle to make the finances stack up. While the council does not have direct control over all schools, officers are urging school leaders and governors to consider amalgamations or mergers if that helps schools survive. Andrew Jameson, the council's deputy leader, said that there was no blanket rule over the size schools needed to be to remain sustainable. He said mature conversations were needed with schools, governors and communities to assess what should happen on a case-by-case basis.
It was once known as the Crew of Norfolk for its train tracks that carried passengers and goods across the county and beyond. Now the village of Milton Constable is putting its railway past back on the map with a new set of signs celebrating its steam-powered heyday. The small community of around 600 people near Holt once served as a key junction to four vital rail lines that linked Norfolk to the Midlands. The station was demolished in 1971, but four of five new signs being installed are seeking to ensure the village's locomotive-laden history is not forgotten. The signs have been thoughtfully crafted to reflect the unique character and history of Melton Constable, said Amanda Yacoubian, the village's clerk. It ensures that both residents and visitors are greeted with a vibrant and welcoming atmosphere. An archway made from metal salvaged from the old railway junction has also been refurbished. The project was commissioned by signwriter Warren Drew, who lives in the village and charged less than £2,000 for the entire project. The signage is now set to play a big part in the upcoming Railway History Festival. The signage will help create a sense of occasion and community spirit, added Miss Yacoubian. Melton Constable continues to grow and flourish, and these new signs are a testament to the village's commitment to preserving its heritage while embracing positive change. The village is thought to have peaked as a transport hub in the early 1900s, where trains from Cromer, North Walsham, King's Lynn and Norwich all travelled through its station. Under LNER ownership, locomotive works were gradually run down and eventually closed in 1934. Between 1959 and 1964 saw the withdrawal of passenger and goods services from Melton Constable before this station was eventually demolished in 1971.
Speed limit signs have been draped in bin bags ahead of a long-awaited limit reduction on a busy Norfolk road. The plastic coverings left many drivers and pedestrians passing by perplexed, but they in fact mark the beginning of a new era of speed limits on stretches of the A140, Cromer Road at Hainford, Hevingham and Stratton Strawless. The new signs were installed last Thursday and the bin bags were to be removed last Friday as the legal order comes into force. People living along the route have campaigned for years for a speed limit, recounting cars and motorbikes racing past at 100 miles an hour, fences smashed by collisions, and frequent deer casualties. Locals have long resorted to their own safety measures, such as erecting handmade signs, urging drivers to slow down. A council investigation last year found the road's accident rate was 1.5 times the national average for a rural A road. The current 50-mile-an-hour speed limit through Hainford will be reduced to 40 miles an hour, while two other sections currently subject to the national 60-mile-an-hour limit will fall to 50 miles an hour. This covers sections from the Green Lane Junction and the Hainford Village sign, and from just after the Fox Pub at Hevingham to the Hainford signs. Shane Ward, Liberal Democrat councillor for Hainford, Hevingham, Stratton Strawless, welcomed the move. He said, "People campaigned for this because of the dangers of crossing the road to get to the bus stop, and also because of people coming out of the side junctions because of the speed. There were also quite a number of deer casualties that had been hit running across the road. We had a mixed reception when we did the campaign, but the vast majority of people are really for it." He added it was a shame the council had not opted to reduce the entire stretch to a 40-mile-an-hour pace. When the decision was announced in December, council officers said a blanket reduction had been rejected, as it was not felt this would be adhered to due to the nature and layout of the road.
Our next few stories include TikTok sensation hosts meet and greet in village, UEA buoyed by boost in student numbers, and NHS Trust sees staff mental health absence rates triple.
A TikTok video has turned a village into a viral sensation. Nearly 3 million viewers have watched the clip, which features TikTok creator Gareth Clark at Garfunkel's and his friend Mel visiting Roy's of Wroxham in Houghton. The light-hearted video playfully compares the number of Roy's stores in the area to scenes from the film Hot Fuzz. Paul Roy, marketing and buying director at Roy's, said, "We've been overwhelmed by the success of the video Gareth created. We wanted to invite Gareth and Mel back to thank them personally for putting Roy's and Houghton on in front of a national audience. The video is a brilliant creative piece of work, and we're incredibly grateful for the joy it has brought." On October the 12th, Mr. Clark and Mel travelled from London to Houghton for a special meet and greet event. Staff, fans and shoppers welcomed them with a looping display of their viral videos in a Roy's window and on in-store TVs. To commemorate the occasion, Roy's presented them with a framed piece of artwork originally created in 1989, now updated to include the duo. Mr. Roy also gave them a guided tour of the Roy's stores and shared insight into the company's 130-year history. Fans of all ages turned out to meet Mr. Clark and Mel, take photographs and join the celebration. Mr. Clark and Mel also enjoyed a boat trip on the Norfolk Broads during their visit. Mr. Roy said, "We weren't sure what to expect from the day, but it turned out to be a truly heartwarming event. Gareth and Mel had a fantastic time exploring the area again, and the response from the public was just incredible."
Norfolk is among the top 10 worst places for mobile phone signal, sparking calls for companies to do more to boost connectivity in rural areas. Signal Checker, which measures mobile phone coverage in the country, has found the county is the 86th worst area in the UK out of 96 regions. A local initiative using bin lorries to track mobile phone use has also identified not spot areas, with North Norfolk communities bearing the brunt of poor coverage. The worst affected areas are the villages sitting between Norwich and Holt and Fakenham to the west. Villages like Banningham and Itringham have complained of having little signal, leaving some people feeling isolated. It can be problematic at times of emergency, causing problems with connecting to emergency services. The issue is affecting businesses, with council officials blaming poor coverage on holding firms back by limiting growth. It is also impacting tourists and can leave visitors struggling to have a successful trip due to problems with digital wayfinding. In a bid to get companies to help these rural areas, Steph Aquarone, Liberal Democrat MP for North Norfolk, has called for better regulation of the likes of Vodafone, EE and O2. He wants to see them given targets for increasing land mass coverage rather than population as part of their service contracts. He said people are deeply frustrated about the lack of coverage in our villages. I have had several hundred people complain to me since being elected. We need to treat mobile services as being as important as electricity and water and need stronger regulations. We need to make it clear to them that rural areas are really important. He added that part of the issue in Norfolk is the changing technology, as the move to 5G requires the rollout of new infrastructure, with 3G networks about to be switched off. The digital switchover also leaves rural communities vulnerable, because if broadband services are lost, then mobile phone coverage becomes a vital lifeline, particularly in emergencies. This makes improving network coverage even more important in the coming years, Mr. Aquarone said. Members of the NNDC Overview and Scrutiny Committee agreed to ask the major mobile network firms to come and speak with them in January, in the hope members can help the companies better understand the challenges faced by North Norfolk communities.
Cold water has been poured over calls for a cross-country rail line which would connect Norwich to Oxford. Regional leaders have said there is a compelling case for the East-West Rail project, which would connect Oxford to Cambridge, to be extended further into Norfolk and Suffolk. A new report by Transport East, an influential lobby group, says the region would reap huge economic benefits if the government scheme continued beyond Cambridge. But Transport Secretary Heidi Alexander, during a visit to Norwich Railway Station, said it was too soon to be considering whether a project, which is still at a relatively preliminary stage, should continue into Norfolk. She said, "We are still in the early phases of delivering that scheme. What we have got to be focused on is making sure we can deliver that scheme to specifications and on budget." Miss Alexander said she was aware of the desire from campaigners, but that she did not want to get ahead of herself by making commitments before the long-term Oxford to Cambridge project is delivered. The East-West Rail project, which would link the Oxbridge cities via Milton Keynes, Bedford and Bicester, is currently estimated to cost between £5.7 and £6.6 billion of public money. By extending it to Norwich, Transport East argues the scheme's benefits would be amplified and spread more broadly by helping Norfolk's burgeoning financial, creative and life science sectors, including at Norwich's Research Park, to develop. The group says the region's potential, including the Norwich to Cambridge Tech Corridor and the opportunities presented by renewable energy to towns such as Great Yarmouth and Lowestoft, is being held back because of poor east-to-west transport connections. They say better rail links, including more frequent trains to Cambridge and beyond, are crucial to helping fulfil that potential and ending a restriction of opportunities for thousands of people.
The troubled University of East Anglia has been handed a timely boost after its new intake produced a sizeable increase in student numbers. The university, which has faced a string of financial challenges in recent years, has seen the student numbers rise by 6.5%. New statistics show that 12,666 undergraduates will be taught at the campus this academic year, following the recruitment of both national and international students. This figure is close to 1,000 more than the 11,887 undergraduates attending in 2024-25, and bosses say overseas recruitment in particular had exceeded expectations. It is the highest number of students at the university since 2022-23, when 13,324 undergraduates attended. The increase will be welcome news to university bosses, who in the past year were forced to put around 170 jobs at risk as part of plans to save millions from its budget. David Maguire, Vice-Chancellor of the University, said, "Our student recruitment for 2025 has been strong, with UK-taught programme intakes on target and international-taught numbers exceeding expectations. This positive outcome reflects the hard work and commitment of staff across the university, and we're grateful for everyone's contributions. We're also seeing encouraging growth in our global reach through the development of new international pathways. These initiatives are enabling more students from around the world to access a UEA education, reinforcing our position as a globally connected institution." Among its new international initiatives, the university has forged a partnership with Amity Global Institute, which has seen its courses taught overseas in Singapore. The university is also set to hold two open days on October 25th and November 29th in the hope of boosting future recruitment. Professor Maguire added, "These events are a key opportunity to explore our campus, meet staff and current students, and experience firsthand what makes UEA such a vibrant place to study."
Quiz night organisers raise more funds for the RNLI. Organisers of Sutton Quiz Night have raised £500 for Haysborough RNLI Lifeboat Station. Maggie and Ken handed over the cheque ahead of Tuesday night training on September the 30th, where they were welcomed by volunteers. The money was raised by members of the local community who took part in the fundraising evening. A spokesperson for the RNLI said the station was grateful to Maggie and Ken and all the Quiz Night heroes for all their efforts. They said their help keeps this fantastic charity afloat. Supporters will have another chance to raise funds later this month when the station hosts its Christmas mince pie open day on Saturday, October the 25th, from 10 a.m. till 3 p.m. Visitors to the site at Cart Gap will be able to buy Christmas cards, calendars and diaries, try their luck on the tombola, and enjoy mince pies, pastries, cakes, coffee and tea, all while supporting the RNLI.
An investigation remains ongoing after a barbershop in Aylsham had money stolen. Main Street Barbers in Red Lion Street had around £40 stolen from the till, according to owner Phil Sad. The theft happened sometime between 2 p.m. on Sunday, October 12th, and 8 a.m. on Monday, October 13th. An unknown suspect forced entry into the building and stole a quantity of cash with one of the glass panes on the front door smashed. A spokeswoman for Norfolk Police said investigations into the incident are ongoing and no arrests have been made yet. Mr. Saad said they only took about £40 in pound coins, amateurs. "We have sports memorabilia everywhere and loads of tools worth a lot. Norwich are playing that badly at the moment. These thieves don't even want their memorabilia." Mr. Saad has installed CCTV and alarms since the burglary.
The number of workers taking time off for mental health issues at the region's ambulance service has more than tripled in the last decade. New figures show an average of 132 employees at the East of England Ambulance Service are taking mental health related leave each month, up from just 37 in 2015. The Trust, which was recently ranked the worst performing in an NHS league table, has faced growing scrutiny over staff welfare. At the time, union bosses said the morale was at rock bottom, and the new figures will raise concerns about a growing sickness culture at the organisation and the impact that might have on its response times and care for patients. The data, which was obtained via a Freedom of Information request, shows that on average last year, 121 members of staff were off each month for mental health reasons. That figure rose to 137 in the first 5 months of 2025. The statistics also paint a wider picture beyond the mental health of staff. They show that reports of physical assaults on paramedics have more than doubled since 2015, rising from 191 to 412 incidents in 2024. Meanwhile, staff are leaving earlier than ever, with annual resignations more than doubling since 2016, and the average length of service dropping from 10.7 years to 8.6. Caroline Hennessy, Unison Eastern Head of Health, said, "Ambulance staff face huge personal challenges every day at work. Too often, staff are expected to simply absorb whatever's thrown at them, but without proper support from managers, workers just can't carry on. And when stress and burnout set in, the situation spirals. Experienced staff quit, leaving bigger gaps and more stress for those remaining. The Trust must do more to protect the health and well-being of staff doing such high-stakes work." The Trust said they are investigating significantly in well-being services. New measures being implemented included a dedicated support hub, 24-hour crisis line, trauma therapists, and a new support app. A spokesman for the Trust said, "We take staff well-being very seriously and offer a wide range of support. Since 2015, our workforce has grown by around 1,000 people. As awareness of mental health has increased, we've worked hard to remove stigma and encourage staff to seek help."
Two former psychiatric hospital bosses who tried to sue Norfolk Police for £30 million have had their case thrown out by the High Court. Andrew Brees and Dominic Wilson wanted to prove that a 2006 police investigation and prosecution against them was malicious and left them in financial ruin. The investigation stemmed from Operation Meridian, which looked at suspected NHS fraud at the Causton Park Hospital near Aylsham. They were ultimately accused of overcharging the NHS for services by around £2.5 million. In 2008, the Crown Prosecution Service decided to charge both men with conspiracy to defraud. But during the trial, the prosecution offered no evidence and both men were acquitted on 16th of June 2009. Mr. Brees and Mr. Wilson filed a claim for more than £30 million in damages in 2014. They accused Norfolk Constabulary of malicious prosecution and misfeasance in public office, stating that officers had deliberately hidden or manipulated evidence, preventing the Crime Prosecution Service from seeing the full picture when making its decision on charges. It was claimed that officers acted out of malice and without genuinely believing the men were guilty. On Friday, October 16th, the High Court dismissed the claim entirely. Chief Constable Paul Sanford said, "This case involved some of the most serious allegations that can be made against police officers. Claims of acting in bad faith, with malice and dishonesty in order to secure charges, without an honest belief in guilt. The judgment handed down today reinforces the importance of integrity in policing. It highlights the professionalism and ethical standards that officers must uphold. The outcome reflects the commitment of those involved in Operation Meridian, including the constabulary's witnesses, in carrying out their duties fairly and responsibly, in service of justice and public trust. It's a testament to the good character of the constabulary's witnesses, all of whom are now retired officers."
Trevor Morris Frost died suddenly on October the 9th, 2025, age 77. Dearly loved husband to Janet. The funeral service will be held at Cromer Crematorium on Tuesday, November the 4th at 12 noon. Family flowers only, please. Donations made payable to RNLI may be left at the service. All inquiries to Fox's Funeral Services, telephone 01263 512 427.
You are listening to edition number 1990 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday, the 24th of October, 2025. Still to come, there are further items from the North Norfolk News, plus our Mardler magazine section. But before that, we have two letters sent to the editor of the North Norfolk News, followed by some events for your diary.
Tracy will be missed at the Mardler. The loyal readers of the North Norfolk News probably won't be aware that the publishers generously allow their articles to be used by the Mardler, a talking newspaper for the blind. Every Thursday, one of the Mardler editors trawls through the latest edition of the paper and decides which articles will be included in the next day's audio recording. On the Friday morning, the producer, four readers and the sound engineer gather in the studio and usually spend just over 3 hours putting the recording together. By lunchtime, the 90-minute master recording is passed to the dispatch team, who then copy it onto USB sticks, which are posted out to our listeners. At the end of every recording, as our theme tune fades out, the team in the studio wish the listeners a hearty cheerio. But this week, we will also be saying cheerio to one of our editors, Tracy Newsome. A creative force, Tracy has made a significant contribution during her time with the Mardler and will be greatly missed. If your readers have friends or family members who are blind or visually impaired, who think they might enjoy keeping up to date with the local news and views from the North Norfolk News, they can contact our listener liaison officer Imogen via email at liaison@mardler.org.uk or telephone 01263 587 610. And that letter was written by Chris Wilson, chair of the Mardler Talking Newspaper. Street collection success. On Saturday, 11th of October 2025, a street collection was held in Cromer Town Centre to raise funds for the RNLI. This was a special event to commemorate the first street collection for the RNLI on this date in 1891. The collection raised £574.35. A coffee morning in the community hall has raised a further £640 before expenses. Cromer Ladies Lifeboat Guild and Supporters Committee would like to thank all collectors, coffee morning helpers and bakers from all sections of the station family. Our thanks also go to the public for their continued support in these difficult times. And that letter comes from Marguerite Leeds, collection organiser.
This week, our What's On page is brimming with fresh ideas to help you shake off the comfort of your cosy corners and embrace something a little different. Whether you're in the mood for live music, a quirky workshop, or a seasonal market stroll, we've rounded up a few tempting picks that might just inspire you to step outside and explore. It's the perfect time to discover something new and make the most of what's happening around you.
Why not celebrate Halloween and also have a spooky-licious time at Holcombe Hall, with a thrilling outdoor experience for the whole family. Spot creepy ghosts, participate in chilling challenges, and enjoy autumn-themed crafts like pumpkin carving. Food trucks will also be on site, offering delicious beverages and cakes, the perfect mix of adventure and festive treats. The event takes place from Sunday 26th of October to Thursday 30th of October. Tickets from £7 and under 12s go free. For more information, go to www.holcombe.co.uk.
Have you been to any of the Vision Norfolk events that take place around our county? One of the regular activities they offer is audio book clubs, which are friendly, informal, and offer a chance to get together and enjoy a chat about a chosen book. The book clubs are free to join, and the audiobooks are supplied. Why not give Mark a call on 01603 573 000 extension 341 to find out more? Cromer Audio Book Club is the third Monday of each month, 2 p.m. to 3:30 p.m. And Great Yarmouth Audio Book Club is the last Friday of each month, 1:30 to 3:30.
If music is more of your go-to for entertainment, then why not go to the Theatre Royal on the 9th of November as the Malta Philharmonic Orchestra will be playing all your classical favourites. For more information and ticket prices, please go to www.norwichtheatre.org.
Have you heard about the Black Swan Pub and Theatre in North Walsham? Not only do they offer events, they also offer classes, workshops and stage events. For instance, there's a people's choir on Tuesdays, 7 to 8:30 p.m. £5 per session, or maybe you would like to brush up your acting skills. For a list of all events and classes, go to Black Swan Pub and Theatre-New Stages.
As Christmas is just around the corner, why not visit one of the many markets around our area for some Christmas present ideas? Aylsham Country Market runs every Friday, 8:30 until noon. There is a cafe and it has recently celebrated its 50th anniversary. Reefham Country Market is another fine example, bursting with homegrown produce and handcrafted goodies. This takes place every Wednesday, 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. Whatever you do this week, we hope you have a lovely time. Welcome to this week's Mardler Magazine Supplement, a rich blend of voices, memories and melodies we hope you'll truly enjoy. In this edition, we hear from some of our cherished Mardler friends and volunteers, each sharing different reflections on life. We complete our scenic journey around the Norfolk coast, soaking in the final views of its rugged charm. Our regular feature, My Music for You, returns with a heartfelt selection to stir the soul. And for those who remember the thrill of the very first vehicle, we revisit that moment. The freedom, the pride, the unmistakable joy. But first, we begin with a tale from the frozen north, read by its author, Tony Escrit.
Hello, my name is Tony Escrit, and here is another of my tales of living in Iceland. Each day brings a new story, some humorous, some humbling, all etched into the icy canvas of the north. So, grab a warm drink, settle in, and let me take you on another journey through the frost-bitten corners of my world. I often say that Iceland is like a somewhat distorted eiderduck, a big body with a jagged head projecting out to the northwest, top left. One leg sticks forward to create the Snæfellsnes Peninsula, while the other leg, I guess, is tucked somewhere underneath the island. The capital, Reykjavik, lies in the southwest corner. In the mid-north, there's a long fjord, Eyjafjörður, Island Fjord, surrounded by mountains which look really majestic in the winter snows. At its southernmost point is Iceland's second largest town, Akureyri, or Akureyri if you come from the south. Face south from there and you'll be looking due south into Eyjafjallajökull. It was spring when my colleague and I drove into the valley. The grassy fields either side of the rough, unmetalled road were still a yellowish colour, yet sheep had been released from their barns to enjoy the sunshine, especially the gambolling lambs who had never seen such space until now. In this outer part of the valley, the farms are substantial. Their red or green corrugated iron roofs supported these days by solid concrete walls. Nevertheless, many of the old turf-roofed houses and barns remain, as generation by generation the landowners have progressed to newer buildings and new facilities. There are very few trees in the landscape, except beside the main house, where rowan have usually been planted. Occasionally, a progressive farmer has planted a small conifer or Arctic willow plantation as a shelter belt or to encourage the wildlife to remain in this otherwise well-managed landscape. In many ways, it is a jewel. From the top fields, the mountains sweep rapidly to their summits. As often as not, a flat surface that reflects the layers of lava flows of which they are made. Over the millennia, the streams and glaciers have carved steep-sided troughs, although few glaciers remain today. Where they do exist, they've been buried in rocks fallen from the valley side, so much so that the glaciers are as much rock as ice. These rock glaciers move in very different ways to the conventional glaciers, and it was part of our remit to provide facilities for British school exploration groups to adopt a glacier for the summer, carry out simple measurements, and submit their reports to the Iceland Glaciological Society. This meant finding base camps on farmland in this magnificent valley. This was to be a nerve-wracking test of my minimalistic Icelandic. Bob, my colleague, spoke none at all. We approached the farm, Grund. A lovely building, flanked by a small church with an onion-shaped top to its small tower. The inside would, we knew, be simply and delicately designed for the local population. I knocked on the farmer's door. After a little while, we could hear footsteps coming from the depths of the farmhouse. The lady of the house cautiously opened the door and looked blankly at these two strangers. Time to launch into Pidgin Icelandic. Golden day in Yeg heiti Tony, og þessan Bob. Við erum skólameistari frá Englandi og við hefum nemandid... She cut me short with a gesture that waved us into the hallway, where we removed our boots before being shepherded into the parlour, clearly one used only for special occasions and guests. With few words, she welcomed us to sit on the sofas while she scurried out, calling, presumably, to the head of the house, the húsbond. We were most impressed by the simple decor of this timber-lined room and of the many old sepia prints, portraits, brasses and woven hangings. After a few minutes, a sturdy, weather-beaten gentleman strode in and gave me a quizzical look. Time to try the Icelandic again. Golden day in Yeg heiti Tony og þessan Bob.
Sæll, Gudmundur. Hvernig að halpa þið?
How can I help you?
Við skólameistari frá Englandi og við hefum skólahópa and koma í august til Vinnarfjöllum.
Jo, jo, said the farmer, nodding his head and looking for more of my Icelandic, scarcely a flicker on his face.
Veður hægt að tjaldar að bænum þínum í hafðir lokum.
Would it be possible for a group to camp on your farm? Again he hummed and nodded, explaining that it would be okay once the first cut of hay had been taken off the infields. At least, we think that was the gist of it. We tried a few more words of explanation from our side of the story, but that wasn't going too far.
Takk fyrir kælega fyrir,
I spluttered in grateful thanks, for having received his permission. We exchanged dates and contact details, as still feeling very nervous, we headed for the door. As we turned towards our car, the farmer, in fluent English,
said, Many thanks for coming. We look forward to seeing you in August. Have a safe journey home.
Oops. Ever felt like falling down a crevasse?
continuing with our journey around our Norfolk coast from local author Judith Ellis and her book Two Points East, we find ourselves having left Cromer and heading eastwards and onwards to Great Yarmouth. The coast from Cromer down to Great Yarmouth has lost a number of villages over the centuries. The Domesday Book records at least 14 villages have been lost and lie unexplored under the sea, including Shipdham and Eccles Juxta Mare, which was built on low-lying land. It was a prosperous fishing village in Saxon times, but by the 12th century sea levels were rising due to the frequency of North Sea storms. Much of the settlement had been destroyed by the late 16th century. The church was destroyed, but the tower remained for another 325 years. In 1604, 2,000 acres were lost and 60 houses were swept away. In 1988, a small team of builders were digging a trench in Haysbury churchyard, and they came across some bones and found an unmarked grave with 119 bodies. It is believed from information passed down over the years, it could be the bodies from a naval ship, the HMS Invincible, under the command of Admirals Nelson and Hyde Parker, and on its way to the Baltic in 1801. Although many lives were lost, there were 190 men saved. You can find a memorial stone in the churchyard between the church and the sea. Travelling eastwards, we come to Great Yarmouth, which began life as a sandbank, which gradually built up between 800 and 1000 AD. During the ensuing warm period for the next 500 years, it emerged from the sea as an island and became populated by fishermen. From 1500 until 1700, there was a little ice age with repeated storms and poor harvests. And during this time, for reasons which remain disputed, the herring moved their spawning ground out of the Baltic and into the North Sea. Although today Yarmouth's glory is largely forgotten, it still has the largest open markets in the country, the oldest civic building in the country, the oldest football stand, and the biggest parish church in Britain. It has the second most complete town wall in the country, became the world's largest herring fishery, and by the turn of the 20th century, it had a leading shipbuilding industry. The geography of Great Yarmouth can be a little confusing due to the configuration of the River Bure and Breydon Water, the body of water seen from the bridge as you drive into the town. The River Bure flows southwards into Breydon, running parallel and very close to the coast. As Yarmouth grew in size, more and more merchants, including many from France, Holland, Italy, and Scandinavia, began to make the annual trek to the town, developing on its sandbank, and soon this annual gathering developed into one of the great fairs of medieval Europe. The fair was held for 40 days from Michaelmas to Martinmas. The huge influx of people made keeping order difficult, and the crown granted the right to men from the cinque ports to appoint two bailiffs for the duration of the fair. As Yarmouth began to emerge as a small town, rivalry began to break out between the local fishermen and those from the cinque ports of Sandwich, Hastings, Romney and Hythe, who had been fishing off Yarmouth for many years. The cinque ports supplied the king with ships before the Royal Navy established, but they also claimed the right to make laws regarding the fishery off Yarmouth. When Yarmouth was later granted its charter by King John, giving the burgesses of the town the right to hold their own courts, the fact that the barons of Hastings also had this right was overlooked, and so the resentment continued, with fights breaking out whenever the two sides met. In 1277, the grievances of both parties were heard in London, and the king ordained the Yarmouth bailiffs should share the administration of the herring fair equally with those of the cinque ports. This peace, however, was never really honoured, and fights continued until 1297, and a battle ensued between the fleet from Yarmouth and the Rosinkports, which were escorting the King of Flanders. 25 ships were sunk, and 200 men died. From the mid-19th century, with the development of free trade, independent ownership of fishing boats, and the coming of the railway, the fishing trade rapidly expanded. The most successful year was in 1913, when there were 227 Yarmouth-registered drifters and 742 Scottish boats, all fishing from Yarmouth. 90% of the catch was being transported to Russia. The port is now mainly associated with the North Sea oil industry, servicing the oil rigs, and the town is a popular destination for holidaymakers. We hope you have enjoyed the journey around the Norfolk coast. You can purchase a book or audible version by visiting www.thebookstudio.co.uk. You will be pleased to hear that the recordings also incorporate the sounds of boats, coast and marsh, as well as original recordings of two folk musicians on melodeon, flute and fiddle.
Next up, enjoy our monthly music pick by Maudler volunteer Clive McCombie. Each selection is a hand-picked mixture of classics and surprises, sure to lift your spirits, stir memories, or introduce something new. Sit back and let Clive take you on a musical journey. These days, there is a plethora of occasions when we celebrate one special time, theme, or group, and it so happens that October the 1st is designated World Opera Day. So this month, we will be all about opera, both orchestral and vocal selections. There will be representatives from France, Italy, Germany, and England. So here goes. Like every good opera, we will start with an overture. In this case, Offenbach's to his opera Orpheus in the Underworld. The composer wrote, "I'm going to write a tragic comic opera with a libretto about a desperate lover going down to hell to search for his loved one." The story is well known. Orpheus found his Eurydice in the Underworld, and all went well until he disobeyed his instructions. As he was leading her back to Earth, he looked back on her, and that was it. She remained in the Underworld forever. Offenbach was a German-born French composer who lived from 1819 to 1880. He was a cellist and an impresario, as well as a composer whose operatic works sit astride the opera-operetta divide, and he heavily influenced the likes of Johann Strauss II and Arthur Sullivan. Orpheus in the Underworld is his first full-length opera-operetta, and it was composed in 1858. It was very well received and is his most performed work in this genre. Others of his stage works are La Belle Hélène and La Vie Parisienne. His work contains risque humour and gentle satire. Moving on to my second choice this month, there is a tenuous connection between Orpheus in the Underworld and Henry Purcell's opera Dido and Aeneas, and specifically the contralto lament aria When I Am Laid in Earth, or Dido's Lament. Purcell's composition is generally regarded as the first English opera, and his only one, where the work is sung through and contains no spoken dialogue. The exact dates of the opera are uncertain, but it was composed no later than 1688. The story is based on Book 4 of Virgil's Aeneid and reworks the story of the unrequited love of Dido, Queen of Carthage, for the Trojan hero Aeneas. The most famous aria in the work is her lament, and while some may not know of its precise provenance, many will nonetheless recognise it because it's played at the annual Cenotaph service in November by a brass band. I would recommend that you seek out Dame Janet Baker recording of this. From England to Italy and the intermezzo from Pietro Mascagni's Cavaliera Rusticana, or Rustic Chivalry. The opera premiered in May 1890 and is often part of a double bill with I Pagliacci. It is a one-act opera and was composed as an entry for a composition for all young Italian composers. From an entry of 73 operas, Mascagni's was one of three chosen and is the only one that remains in the regular repertoire. The intermezzo is the most familiar tune from the whole opera. Finally, to Mozart's opera, The Magic Flute, or Die Zauberflöte. As you may perhaps remember, my last choice is sometimes one that has some particular significance for me. This time, it reminds me of my first engagement in South Africa, when I was asked to take the part of Sarastro, the High Priest, in a semi-staged version of the opera in a theatre north of Johannesburg. In many ways, it was a defining moment of my time in South Africa and led to many other engagements. The Magic Flute was Mozart's last opera and was premiered just 2 months before his death in 1791. The opera is noted for its prominent Masonic elements. Mozart himself was a Freemason. This underlying theme was combined with Enlightenment, philosophy, and Sarastro is the leader of this movement. In both his arias, he sets out many of the Masonic principles of love, brotherhood, and reverence for the gods Isis and Osiris. I've chosen the second aria, Within These Sacred Walls, or in the German, In diesen Heiligen Hallen. You may also care to explore Isis and Osiris, as well as the famous Queen of the Night aria, Papageno's aria, his duet with Papagena, and Tamino's famous aria, O Loveliness Beyond Compare. This is referring to his love for Pamina. The opera is shot through with famous tunes and arias, not forgetting the famous overture. I hope that you continue to enjoy my selections and look forward to being with you again in November, which will be my last contribution of the year.
For our final magazine article this week, we hear from Mardler friend Pat Newsom and his first taste of life on the open road, entitled From Vespa to Mercedes, A Teenage Journey on Two Wheels and Beyond. The moment I turned 16 and could legally hold a provisional licence, I made my first purchase with the kind of excitement only a teenager can muster. A bright red Vespa, hand-painted no less. It wasn't just a scooter, it was a symbol of freedom, rebellion and the open road. Unfortunately, it was also a mechanical disaster. The 125cc engine was woefully underpowered and the wheel nuts were held on with plastic padding. A bodge job familiar to anyone who grew up fixing rust buckets with more hope than money. Back in the 1960s, Vespas weren't exactly the epitome of cool. My heart was set on an MK3 Lambretta 200cc, the holy grail of stylish scootering. Whether it was the TV model, or, if fortune smiled, the newer SX version, owning one meant instant street cred. But around £20, it was a stretch for a schoolboy. So I returned to the indignity of pedal power, saving every penny until the day I had £21 in hand. That day, a mate's brother offered me a souped-up TV200. It had been bored out to 238cc's by a local engineering firm, a common trick among Lambretta enthusiasts. Special cylinder rings were fitted to accommodate the new bore and supposedly carry enough two-stroke oil. Allegedly, because while this beast could hit 70 miles an hour, terrifying on those tiny wheels, it had a nasty habit of seizing up at speed, locking the drivetrain, and sending you into a tail-end skid that could ruin your day, or your face. Starting it was another ordeal. The spark plug needed cleaning every single time. I got so good at it I could do it blindfold. But it looked the part, navy and white, crash bars, mirrors, it was a head-turner. Still, I quickly learnt that tuned-up motors were like nervous horses, unpredictable and best avoided. I sold it and bought an SX200, the scooter of dreams. Gold and white, dripping in chrome and mirrors. It was everything I'd wanted. I felt like a king zipping through the Suffolk countryside. But as with all youthful obsessions, my attention began to drift. Cars were calling. I sold the Essex to fund a minivan, though I couldn't afford one just yet. In the meantime, I picked up a dirt-cheap Lambretta TV200. Ironically, it turned out to be the best scooter I ever owned. It started reliably and kept going, a rare trait in those days. Despite the many cars I've owned since, nothing compares to the thrill of threading a fast scooter through traffic on the old Felixstowe Road. You're close to the ground, the engine buzzes beneath you, and the brakes are laughable. Helmets were optional and decidedly uncool. Why were we always racing to Felixstowe, you may ask? Because we were young, free, and in our final year of school. Exams were behind us, and university was a distant thought. We'd lounge outside Charlie Manning's amusements, drink beer, smoke fags, and chat up girls. Life was simple and exhilarating. Music was everywhere, Ipswich, Colchester, even Cambridge, a risky ride on a Lambretta, hosted bands like John Mayall, Peter Green, Free, Taste, and Duster Bennett. It was a golden era for live music, and we were right in the thick of it. Of course, the police didn't share our enthusiasm. Our long hair and noisy scooters made us frequent targets. Accidents were common, some amusing, others less so. Petrol was bought by the pint, and we were perpetually broke. Publicans eyed us with suspicion as we swaggered in, soaked from the rain, wearing cut-down CD coats and loon pants. The tension was palpable. One unforgettable incident involved my mate Paul, who failed to notice a closed level crossing. He hit the gates full tilt, flew through the air and landed on the other side with just a few scrapes. His Essex 200 was wrecked and British Railways sent him a bill for the gates. As for me, I still carry a piece of grit in my face from a high-speed slide across gravel. When my doctor asks about neck pain, I just say, "Well, Doc, it was like this." Eventually, I got my Vinnie van, carpeted floor to ceiling, no rear windows, and a registration I'll never forget, CHR608. It was a rust bucket with a dying subframe and shot universal joints. Classic mini problems. After a year, it was time to move on. Enter the Vauxhall Viva HA, courtesy of my dad. No family discount, of course, but I scraped together the cash. It was a proper car, capable of real journeys. To the Lake District, to Wales, my motoring life had truly begun. From there, it was a parade of Renaults, each more luxurious than the last. Then came the company cars, Montegos, Mondeos, Omegas, each one a step up in badge and bravado. Eventually, I graduated to Saab 9000s and Mercedes, the pinnacle of corporate motoring. Free cars every 3 years, all maintenance covered. It was motoring nirvana. Then I retired. Suddenly, I was back in the showroom, wallet in hand, squinting at price tags and wondering if a heated steering wheel was really worth it. Full stop.
And those items conclude this week's magazine supplement. Our thanks go to the authors of these articles for their contributions. Returning to the news, our penultimate selection of articles includes speed camera vans clock over 4,000 speeders, restaurant owner takes on extra jobs, new travel hub to be built and cosy pub up for sale.
More than 4,300 motorists on Norfolk roads were caught over the speed limit by camera van checks in August. Roadside operations by the Norfolk and Suffolk Safety Camera Partnership covered main routes including the A11 and A47, as well as smaller routes in numerous towns and villages across the county. As with the 8 previous months, the biggest speeding hotspot was Thetford, where 436 motorists were detected to be travelling over the limit. In total, 2,309 separate fines have been issued to drivers at just this one location since March. Cameras positioned at the busy Broadland interchange on the A47 at Postwick with Witton on the outskirts of Norwich clocked 402. Camera vans are often deployed on bridges overlooking the carriageway or in laybys to use video speed monitoring tech. Motorists caught are sent a notice of intended prosecution, but for more serious speeding offences, like where drivers are caught at particularly high speeds, the police may choose to take cases straight to court. Others are fined or offered speed awareness courses.
A Norfolk Bistro owner says soaring costs and higher taxes have left him with no choice but to take on shifts working in the kitchens of other restaurants and garden centres to support his family. Chef Matt Gibson, who owns Gibson's Bistro in Cromer alongside his wife Emily, says rising operating costs have forced them to scale back opening hours to evenings and weekends, making half of their staff redundant. The couple have now liquidated their company, Gibson's Bistro Limited, with another company owned by Mr. Gibson taking over the restaurant. "I'm working so hard, but it's not enough," said Mr. Gibson, who opened the bistro in Church Street in 2023. "I've had to go out and get another job, and I'm currently working in a garden centre, as we've had to shut the place so much because the cost of opening is so high. I was in there 15 hours a day, but taking home £1,000 a month and struggling to feed my family. If I pay myself any more money, the government will just tax me even more." The couple put the business up for sale in January, with plans to start a new life in Dubai. However, they say it is no longer for sale, despite it still being listed on the market by commercial property estate agent Paul Hubbard Commercial. Gibson's Bistro Limited will now be wound up voluntarily, with Paul George and Kate Cutler of Lancashire-based Business Helpline Group being appointed liquidators of the company. He declined to comment on whether there were any creditors who are still owed money. "We're trying to have a fresh start," Mr. Gibson said. "I want to keep Gibson's alive for the people who enjoy it and keep my family supported. But with everything that's going on in the world at the moment, it's really tough. When you walk around Cromer, all that's open during the daytime is the franchise cafes. It's shocking."
A £580,000 project to build a new travel hub in a seaside town will begin later this month. The hub will be located in Station Approach, Sheringham, and will include a new bus shelter with a screen displaying real-time information for passengers. The pavement will also be widened to create a bigger waiting area. Between the new bus stop and the North Norfolk Railway buildings, there will be a bicycle parking area, a cycle repair station, a water bottle filling station, artwork, green space and biodiversity areas and more seating. The first phase of the scheme will run from October the 27th until December the 19th. The site will be accessed from the station car park, meaning a small number of spaces will be temporarily unavailable during this time. The second phase will commence on January the 5th and continue until February the 27th, and Station Road will need to be closed during this period. A fully signed diversion route will be in place and a temporary arrangement will be made for bus services. A Norfolk County Council spokesman said, "The County Council thanks people for their patience while this travel hub improvement work is carried out."
A cosy country pub in the Norfolk countryside has gone up for sale. The Crown in Banningham, near Aylsham, is being marketed by Paul Hubbard Commercial. The venue dates back to the 17th century and has plenty of traditional features such as wooden beams and log fires, which are lovely to curl up in front of during the cooler months. Diners can order from a full à la carte menu or opt for a Sunday roast or bar snacks. The venue can accommodate 150 covers inside, and another 60 people can sit outside. There are parking spaces for more than 60 cars, and a three-bed owner's accommodation also sits on the 1.2-acre plot. A spokesman for Paul Hubbard Commercial said, "The Crown has built an excellent reputation in the local area. It's listed by camera, included in the Good Beer, Good Pub guide, and is very much part of the community, hosting live music, quiz nights, and seasonal or special events. The freehold is available for purchase at £900,000. There are currently 17 employees in the team who would all stay under new ownership. They're experienced enough that a hands-off owner could delegate much of the day-to-day running of the business."
An actor who has starred in Star Wars, Shaun of the Dead and Guardians of the Galaxy has been spotted in Norfolk. Peter Serafinowicz visited the Victory Swim and Fitness Centre in North Walsham on Friday. He's believed to have been visiting family and was happy to pose for photos with the team. They shared the snaps to their Facebook page alongside a caption which said the meeting left staff starstruck. "A huge thank you to Peter for taking the time to stop by," the message continued. "You brought some serious star power to Victory today. Keep doing all the amazing work you do." The 53-year-old is perhaps best known as the voice of Darth Maul in Star Wars Episode 1, Pete in Shaun of the Dead, Garth and Sahl in Guardians of the Galaxy, and the big voice of Big Daddy in Sing and Sing 2. His comedy sketch show, The Peter Serafinowicz Show, was BAFTA-nominated in 2009, and he more recently played Johannes in the BBC sitcom Amandaland.
A driver has been interviewed under caution after a man suffered life-changing injuries in a crash in Aylsham. The victim was riding a black Suzuki SV650 when it collided with a yellow skip lorry on the B1145 on July 11th. The road was closed at 3:20 p.m. with an ambulance and an air ambulance attending the scene. The biker, a man in his 50s, was taken to hospital with life-changing injuries. A spokeswoman for Norfolk Constabulary said the driver of the skip lorry, a man in his 60s, was interviewed under caution.
A seafood firm has been ordered to pay nearly £3,000 to a former employee after breaching the terms of his contract. CA Seafoods, a family-run business based in North Norfolk, was taken to court by a disgruntled staff member. According to court documents, Judge McCooey, who presided over the case, found claimant Stephen Smith's employment contract was breached by the firm. It is understood this was related in part to the staff member not being paid for holidays accrued but not taken on the date the claimant's employment ended. CA Seafoods also failed to provide a written statement of employment particulars, details of the conditions of employment when they started work, after the court proceedings began. This meant the firm was in breach of its duties as an employer, resulting in Judge McCooey fining CA Seafoods £1,438. However, a further claim that Mr. Smith had been unfairly dismissed was withdrawn. In total, CA Seafoods was ordered to pay £2,909 to Mr. Smith. CA Seafoods has been approached for comment. The company runs the fishmongers in Sheringham's High Street and also has its own smokehouse.
Our last few articles cover Coastal Walk, one of UK's best, young farmers thanked for huge charity effort, swimming medals won, and shorelark seen on our coast.
A charming coastal walk which passes the home of Atlantic seals has been named one of the UK's best. The Express newspaper recently published an article that ranked the seven best seaside strolls across the country. The path from Horsey Windpump to Waxham in Norfolk came an impressive fourth place. Calling the route charming, the author explained it would lead right to the home of Atlantic seals at Horsey Gap. Just before you visit these enchanting creatures, you'll be able to forage for blackberries in the hedgerows and trek through sand dunes. Take note of the special rules that depend on the time of year. Between November and January, it is officially seal breeding season, and you won't be allowed onto the beach. But you can still take a look down from the path above. Some of the other walks included were the Lizard Peninsula Circular Walk in Cornwall, which came in second place, and the coastline from Seatown to West Bay in Dorset, which came first.
North Walsham Young Farmers Club, YFC, has been thanked by the East Anglian Air Ambulance crew for a potentially life-saving £5,500 fundraising donation. The huge sum of money was raised in December at the club's annual charity Christmas Light Tractor Run, which featured more than 100 vehicles, decorated with fairy lights and festive decorations. The club said it was thrilled with the amazing success of the event, which had grown from 60 tractors and £1,600 raised for charity the previous year. And the EAAA thanked the young farmers for their fundraising efforts during a talk for YFC members at Norwich Airport this month. Club spokesperson Annabel Collar said, "East Anglian Air Ambulance is a charity providing advanced critical care 24/7, 365 days a year to the most seriously ill and injured people by air and road. We chose the EAAA as our charity as they receive no regular government funding and they rely almost entirely on public donations. Currently, the average cost per tasking is £4,250, which the NHS can't fund. We also chose this charity as many of our members work in agricultural and are often in remote and rural locations, so you never know when you might need them. The tractor run is set to return this winter, planned for Saturday, December 13th.
A rare bird with distinctive black horns has been spotted on the North Norfolk coast. Keen birder Matt Saunders came across the shorelark on the east bank at Clye on Saturday and was lucky enough to capture a series of images. Mr. Saunders said it was one of the most obliging shorelarks you'll ever see. Shorelarks are considered rare in the UK, as only small numbers of them visit from their usual homes in Scandinavia each winter. They can be recognised by their distinctive yellow and black face markings and black feather tufts which look like horns. It is because of this feature that Americans tend to call them horned larks. Shorelarks are slightly smaller than a skylark, only weighing around 36 grams. As their name suggests, they prefer to stay in coastal areas where they can feed on the seeds of washed-up salt marsh plants. When they visit the UK, they tend to prefer being on the east coast.
Two young swimmers have won 16 gold medals between them at a competition. George Edridge and Anna Turner represented the North Norfolk Vikings Swimming Club at the gala hosted by Dereham Otters Swimming Club. George collected 9 gold medals. He swam 100-metre freestyle in 59.68 seconds. He then went on to win the 200-metre individual medley and 200-metre breaststroke, breaking his record by 5 seconds. George swam the 100-metre butterfly in 1 minute 11.63 seconds, reducing his time by 3 seconds, just 3 days before his 16th birthday. Anna Turner won 7 out of 7 and set a personal best on each occasion. In the 100-metre backstroke, she completed 50 metres in just 39.3 seconds, and then, with an adroit turn and transition into the stroke, the 11-year-old scored 1 minute 21.28 seconds, easily winning the event and breaking her own record by 4 seconds. Anna achieved back-to-back breaststroke golds. In the 100 metres, it was a personal best by 6 seconds in 1 minute 30.32 seconds, and in the 50 metres, she dominated the race, finishing in 41.21 seconds. Anna said, "I never expected to come back with 7 gold medals.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, you can contact our listener liaison officer, Imogen Waterson, on 01263 587 610.
Perhaps we should just mention that if you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker, a variety of smartphone apps, or even a telephone call to listen. Find out the details on our website, mardler.org.uk.
We rely on receiving your returned memory sticks and pouches so that we can continue to send you new editions each week. So please remember to return the pouch and memory stick promptly, making sure to reverse the address label first.
The sound engineer today was Richard Preston. Editing and producing this issue for her last time was Tracy Newsome.
Our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in wishing you the best of health. And we look forward to joining you again in a week's time. But for now, it's
cheerio!